You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help.
We're joined today by four authors who have all come from very different professional backgrounds and who all turn that into very different kinds of fiction. But what they have all in common, and the reason we asked them all here today, is that they all do it very well. So I'm going to introduce them, but not their full introductions, because, man, these are some accomplished authors. It would take half the time to introduce all of them, the full thing. So you're just going to get a gist of who these people are. We have Sean McFate, who is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and a professor of strategy at the National Defense University and Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. In addition to several nonfiction books, Sean is the author of the Tom Locke series of novels, the newest of which is High Treason, which just came out earlier this month. Thank you, Sean. We also have Alex Finley, who's a former officer of CIA's Directorate of Operations, where she served in West Africa and Europe. Her writing has appeared in Slate, Reductress, Funnier, Die, Politico, and other publications. She's the author of Victor in the Rubble, a satire about the CIA and the War on Terror, and Victor in the Jungle, a satire about the pitfalls of populism. Thank you, Alex. We also have P.W. Stingers, a strategist at New America and a professor of practice at Arizona State University. Along with a number of nonfiction books, he's also the co-author of a new type of novel, using the format of a techno-thriller to communicate nonfiction research. Ghost Fleet, a novel of the next world war, was both a top summer read and led to briefings everywhere from the White House to the Pentagon. His latest is Burn In, a novel of the real robotic revolution, which has been out for just about a month now, so you should check that out. And finally, we have Brad Thor, who is the number one New York Times bestselling author of 20 thrillers, good Lord, including Backlash, Spy Master, The Last Patriot, Blowback, and The Lions of Lucerne. His newest book, Near Dark, comes out in just about a month on July 21st and can be pre-ordered now, of course. So thank you for being here today. We really appreciate you taking the time. I'm going to try to corral the crazy by pinpointing questions to specific authors, but it doesn't mean that author is the only one that can possibly answer this question. So feel free to jump in. But let me start with you, Brad. As the one full-fledged professional writer from the get-go, you know, you started your career in entertainment and then writing. Let me ask you, when you started, you didn't necessarily have life experience to draw upon. How did you go about researching for your books? How did you work to get it right? I know you've shadowed units in Afghanistan. You've done things like that. Can you talk a little bit about how you got into the business of writing this world?
Great, great question. So Stephen King once said, and I really believe this is a great piece of advice, don't write what you know, write what you love to read, because that's where your passion is. And believe it or not, you've got a mini PhD in that genre because you've been reading it for years. Now, my dad's a Marine, no longer active. We had a very close friend of the family who was a SAC for the FBI. His last post was in New Jersey. And I had a neighbor when I was going to USC who was part of an interesting intelligence unit at Fort Bragg, where they shared a compound with Delta. Before Delta built their new compound, it was called, they used to call it the Fiesta Cantina because of the buildings and stuff. And these guys, the Army had combed through the Ranger battalions looking for people who had grown up speaking German. And they recruited these soldiers and trained them and put them in Berlin so that if the Russians ever overran the wall, this was a guerrilla force that was there with radio sets plastered up behind walls and beer stubes and weapons caches and Krugerrands. The idea was is they would slow the Soviets down if they ever overran the wall. And this was a neighbor of mine. So I parlayed this in another relationship with Harry Humphreys, who was one of the original plank owners of SEAL Team 6, into, listen, can I buy a beer? Can I buy a steak dinner? Can I ask you, what can you tell me about tradecraft and all this kind of stuff? So basically I went out and put together my own mini PhD, would be really overblowing it, but trying to understand what the training's like, what the situations they face and that kind of stuff. It's just on the ground, hardcore research is what it was.
Sean, let me ask you about your protagonist, because I think I'm interested to know how much of you did you put into Tom Locke? Are your personalities similar? You draw upon yourself to decide which direction to take his character. You know, specific experience.
Thank you. I mean, Tom Locke is essentially me, but he's much more badass and a lot more damaged. I began writing fiction by accident. I was actually writing a memoir of some stuff I had been doing in Africa as a private military contractor, sort of a paramilitary for the US government. And we did some really cool stuff, stuff that the CIA or special forces would traditionally do. But my agent was like, no, 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 Sean, if you write that, you'll be sued to death. So he said, fictionalize it. I'm like, fictionalize it? That's, you know, very competitive. It's, you know, it's full of people like Brad Thor and stuff like that. So, and so, but it launched the series. And Tom Locke is me had I stayed in that world. And the purpose of the novels is to have a good time, but also to pull back the curtain on a new way that foreign policy is executed today, and that's by contract.
In contract, you know, fancy way, the way we say lethal action for assassination, contract military is a fancy way of saying mercenaries.
That's right, the M word, yes.
That's the kind of dirty way of putting it. So let me turn to you, Alex. You're a former operations officer at CIA. In your novels, I have to say, you hilariously skewer the agency forward, backward, and sideways, or at least your fictional version of the CIA, the CYA. I'm wondering about the response from your former colleagues. Regardless of your satirical angle of your novels, there's a lot of sad truth in your book. So how have the people who you work with professionally reacted to your fiction?
I am very happy to see that. Actually was my biggest fear writing that first novel, writing Victor and the Rubble, was how my former colleagues would respond to it. And I have to say I had really good feedback. And a lot of them came to me and said, you know, finally somebody has written about the agency in a way that really actually gets at the truth. It isn't as wonderful as these thriller books can be. They're not always very close to the sort of mundane reality that we face when we're overseas. I'm the buzzkill who tells James Bond he has to do his, you know, his expense reports, and Moneypenny telling him, I hope you have personal liability insurance for that Aston Martin. So I was really pleased with the feedback. And in fact, I have on good authority that one chief of station in Africa made Victor and the Rubble a mandatory reading for anybody coming to his station.
The book, just, you laugh at just the mundane. It's just wonderful, the bureaucracy of the everyone's dealt with PowerPoint and wanted to throw a computer through a wall. But you don't think about James Bond trying to get a PowerPoint ready, or others that way as well. So let me turn to you, Peter. When a lot of your contemporaries in the spy techno thriller field were keeping things, let's say, relatively small and contained, terrorists, individuals working inside of, outside of government, you and your co-author, August Cole, went full Red Storm Rising and kicked off a full-blown shooting war with China and Ghost Fleet. Now in Burn-In, you have AI, cyber terrorism, robotics. How do you choose your bad guy? How do you choose from all the potential threats out there, Russia, the Norks, bioweapons, whatever, who are represent your principal antagonist in the novels that you're writing?
So we feel like we're serving sort of twin masters in this. One is the gods of writing and entertainment. So we try and pick what we think is going to be the most compelling story. And that's not just on your bad guys. It's also when you're thinking about your heroes. But also we're trying to share across important issues that we don't think are all that well understood. So for Ghostfleet, when we started it, it was actually back, 2013. And both all of the attention in the policy world was on terrorism, counterinsurgency. And we were saying, no, you have the rise of a China. You have the return to something that we'd not been thinking about, great power rivalry, even the idea of a great power war, which had been unthinkable for a generation. And that was a little bit kind of anathema, but yet we wanted to push forward with it. But the funny thing was we got the same kind of pushback from the publishing world. Most of the stories, even Clancy, had gone to terrorism kind of stories. And we were saying, no, actually, you could go back to these big, Red Storm Rising-like novels, and they would be all the more compelling because guess what? That's where the real world is headed as well. And the same thing with Burn-In. Most of the narrative around AI is around robot uprising, and yet we're living as this science fiction becomes real. And so it allows you to explore in the real world these sci-fi themes, but in kind of a manner that's more exciting because it's happening in familiar places and playing out in ways that we will all experience.
And one of the really interesting things, if you follow Pete's Twitter feed, is seeing the Ghostfleet moments being called pulled out as real life actually catches up with the novel, which is set a little bit into the future. You're gonna see something similar, I expect, looking at Burn-In, with the kind of Burn-In moments where reality catches up with fiction.
Yeah, I would say, Vince, one of the things that has been kind of interesting and disturbing to us, we've also been doing these hashtag Burn-In book moments, is that I knew the technology part would come true. Because the book, it's a novel, but with endnotes, so we can document the research. The part I was not prepared for was the dystopian aspects coming true. Like, there's a moment in the book, it's all set in Washington, D.C., and there's a militarized high fence thrown up around the White House, and it was exactly where they put it in reality. Or there's another moment that we thought would be, so dystopian, riot police around the base of the Lincoln Memorial. I think it was like 9 days after the book came out. And so, that's a situation where you don't want to be like, I told you so. But it's also, I think, shown the value of using these, fiction as a way of sharing real world research.
Well, I appreciate all of that. I wrote a book that included using nuclear weapons against hurricanes and saw where that got us moving forward. Let me ask a question of Peter and Brad, and let me ask you about the power of fiction. Ghostfleet was read by a huge chunk of the U.S. NatSec community, and Brad, you're part of the Department of Homeland Security's Analytic Red Cell Unit. I'm guilty, I'll admit this, of not giving fiction the respect it perhaps deserves. In what ways can fiction be used beyond its entertainment value? Let's go through.
That's a great question. I think it was Dan Brown, and Dan and I are pals, that said a thriller writer's job is to beat the headlines. So for those who are watching, listening, that don't know what the Analytic Red Cell Unit was, its name has been changed, but it's just like SEAL Team 6, the evolutions of the names, DevGru or whatever. But in the wake of 9/11, when the Department of Homeland Security was created, the federal government, before the 9/11 Commission report, realized that 9/11 happened in part because of a failure of imagination on the part of the United States government. So this problem of always fighting the next war by looking in your rearview mirror or the next threat was a problem. And so the federal government, is probably one of the most forward-thinking and aggressive programs I've ever seen them put into place, said, let's get outside the beltway thinking and bring it into DC and bring in creative people that might not be at DIA or CIA or the NSA. Let's bring in creative people and have them work with us in trying to come up with scenarios that we might not be thinking about. What are some potential soft targets in the US? What are threats to American citizens abroad and all this kind of stuff? And it was really impressive because when you get creative people together, they're not necessarily super disciplined. So the fact that they were like, you know, herding cats is the one thing that I always think of, but the fact that they could get people to focus and put them with all the alphabets in the soup and come up with scenarios. In fact, I remember I came up with one scenario that that got a little traction inside of DHS. And then that exact scenario played out overseas. And I said to the person that I was working with there, that was kind of my contact, I said, okay, can I, now this is in the newspaper, can I say this is one of the things that we developed? And they said, nope. What happens in the Red Cell program, I joke, it's like Las Vegas. What happens in the Red Cell program stays in the Red Cell program. The only thing they ever popularized and publicized was a hurricane event where they said one of the Red Cell things they'd looked at was what would happen if terrorists focused on an area that was about to get hit by a hurricane, either going to relief centers or the way we marshal trucks and forces and all that kind of stuff outside the path of the hurricane to bring those in. So I do think it's valuable. I think creative people can come up with ideas that are, you know, some of them are going to be way too far outside the box. But, you know, I'd always heard for years the story at the Pentagon of all the binders. Okay, the Canadians are invading. Pull that binder down. You know, we've war game this. What are we going to do?
Peter, how about you?
So we stumbled into this. You know, we originally wrote Ghost Fleet mostly for the entertainment value, much like Brad was saying. You know, we wanted to give people the kind of experience that we had personally enjoyed, you know, reading early Tom Clancy. And yet along the way, the book ended up having greater policy influence than my nonfiction books had. You know, as you mentioned, we were briefing at the White House, Senate testimony. It caused multiple different actual real-world investigations to happen. To the Navy even created a $3.6 billion ship program called Ghost Fleet. Now, they gave us $0 out of it. I needed a better agent on that. But from that experience, that's we sort of leaned into that in Burn-In and you know, baked that into the very concept of the project. But what it comes back to is three things that we've discovered about this idea of useful fiction. The first is that narrative can have a more powerful and more effective way of sharing ideas. The researchers call this synthetic environments. And the simple way to think about it is that your brain is programmed to take in story in a better way. It's the oldest communication technology versus a PowerPoint 30 years old. The second is narrative hits. It's not just easier to understand concept. It hits emotions and causes action. So for example, some admirals talked to us about how they were they read Ghost Fleet. It was a nightmare scenario for them. And then they wanted to act to make sure that nightmare scenario didn't come true. And then the third is novels and narrative of any kind are more likely to be shared. No one ever said, oh man, that was such a good PowerPoint. The next vacation you're on, you ought to take it with you. You know, no one ever said, man, you know, I needed to go to sleep, but I just sat up in bed reading that white paper. But they do that about novels. They want to talk to other people about it. They want to share it, including some of the most powerful people. And, you know, we've already seen that with Burn-In. The book's only been out a couple of weeks. And, you know, I've briefed it everything from senators to literally 30 minutes ago with leaders in the British military. And it's a novel. But, you know, I'm getting in there because of the novel and baking and sneaking in the important stuff. I think of it as I'm a parent. It's like sneaking fruit and veggies into a smoothie.
Well, Sean, there's a similar aspect with what you write about because your nonfiction and your fiction overlap very much. In your nonfiction, you're advocating for more usage of private contractors, more usage of this. And then of course, the novelization of that is what you're getting with the Tom Locke series. Was this purposeful now, or at least is it now becoming purposeful where you're trying to interweave your fiction and your nonfiction?
It is purposeful now. It didn't start out that way. I mean, I write academic nonfiction, serious nonfiction, but also narrative nonfiction. I find that my novel writing skills improve my nonfiction skills and vice versa. But you know, I find that fiction, to agree with Peter and Brad, is a magnificent vehicle for truth telling. because you it's not because you can reveal the emotional aspects of situations so that the reader is immersed in it in the way that sort of like, you know, Dolby 7.0 or whatever movie theaters are. And that is that communicates at non, shall we say, like cognitive levels that are subterranean. And so I wrote a book called The New Rules of War, a nonfiction book that is, you know, briefing other governments, other entities. That is the cosmos of the Tom Locke series. So if you want to see what it looks like on the ground, you read the novel, and it also points back to nonfiction and vice versa. I think those who can write serious fiction as well as serious, well, they can write fiction that's fun and serious nonfiction, it is a way to reach people.
I want to ask all of you about the freedom granted by fiction writing. I want to start with you, Alex. One of the most ridiculously funny things about the terrorists and Victor in the rubble is that, I'll be honest with you, they were just like us. They're the same bureaucratic BS we deal with every day. And I have to say, I found that very ballsy to do that, right? The idea is you're laughing because terrorists in a cave are having trouble with their briefing. And we're supposed to villainize the bad guys. We're supposed to see them as others. But you put them in a position where you're almost empathizing with their bureaucratic troubles because you know you've dealt with it yourself. Is there a freedom that you're granted to go, I know there's absurdity, but there's of course a kernel of truth in the absurdity, but how much fun can you have beyond what you kind of limitations of nonfiction when you're writing a novel like that?
So yeah, it's funny you ask. I mean, the people sort of look at me strange when they say you wrote a satire of the war on terror. Like what, how could there possibly be anything to laugh about with the war on terror? But there is. I was in the agency, I joined in early 2003, so it was just after 9/11 and just before Iraq. So it was a very strange time, and you know, eventually we had the Iraq War and then the 2004 intelligence reform. So everything was changing and moving at the time, and it was a lot of dysfunction and a lot of absurdity. And so the question is, well, how do you deal with that? And not just me, but a lot of friends who were in these positions and in, you know, separations and going through a lot of hardships. You have to process it somehow. And I guess it's that laugh or cry thing. And I decided that satire was a good way to deal with it. And like what the other author said, I found that fiction was a good way to help me highlight a lot of the truth of it without giving away also anything classified. I still have to run everything I write through the publications review board at the CIA. So, you know, I wanted to be able to explain a lot of these crazy things that I had seen. And then putting the terrorists in the positions that we were in, that was really what I wanted to do. I took our bureaucracy, I put it on the terrorist organization and said, well, let's sort of see what happens. And it doesn't go very well, like you said. I mean, you're kind of rooting for the guy at the end. You feel a little bit bad for him.
Well, and that's what I want to ask you about. I mean, I think that's the it's rare. There's so many kind of black and white cut and paste bad guys in a lot of the thrillers that are out there. Not obviously by the four of you, because we wouldn't have you here otherwise. How do you avoid that? Do you have to be empathetic in some respects to the bad guy in order to write good characters? So Alex, continue on. Do you have to be empathetic a little bit to the terrorists in the caves? Or to the autocrat in South America, get inside their shoes and think about them in order to write an effective bad guy?
Well, I mean, that actually also was part of my job, right? I worked in counterterrorism, and when I was in West Africa, that was what I was focusing on. And actually, Mokhtar Belmokhtar, who is a main big terrorist dude in the Sahel, was sort of the model for Omar el-Suqqat, who's my main terrorist. And so, you know, I did a lot of research on him. I studied who he was. Why was he doing the things that he was doing? And same with all of these groups that were, you know, these franchises, as I call them, that were popping up all over the time, all over the place. Even Al-Qaeda, UBL. What makes these people tick? Why are they doing what they're doing? And that was part of my job, was trying to understand that. And you have to see them as humans, as complex humans. They They don't see themselves as bad guys, right? They think they're doing things for a certain reason. They have families and those types of things. And so you do need to be, you need to understand who you're up against. And so it's not a black and white thing. Every human is nuanced and complex.
Let me ask you a similar question. I mean, to write Ghost Fleet, you kind of had to get into the heads of some of the strategic thinkers inside China to kind of understand a little bit about why they were thinking the way they were. And does that take lots of research, or you just kind of get a general idea and roll with it there?
Well, I wanted to echo something that Alex said, and I think it's important in both the fiction and when you're doing real world work with agencies, in advisory work or consulting or wargaming or whatnot, is that everyone is the hero in their own story. Everyone is also the victim in their own story. And so, a flaw of, frankly, not great fiction, but also really bad planning, whether it's in counterterrorism or military plans, is to have an adversary who's that, pulling the mustache and acts the way, they're flat, they're one-dimensional. They've got, a set plan that what the plan is. That's not interesting. It's not entertaining. It's also not useful when you put on your real world hat. And so, that I think is important to remember. Now, in terms of, I do research, and the research is, it might be pulling from documents, here's various doctrine and the like. It's also like you would do is, it's research in terms of sometimes it's interviews, and you're trying to not just get facts, but little quirks of characters, the way they talk, a little mention of a phrase, the way they sit. You're trying to pick up those little details that sell a scene. And sometimes you don't get the opportunity for a full interview, but you can be a fly on the wall. So to the example of China, you can pull up everything from doctrine to I've been able to send it on various sessions with Chinese officers. And so there are certain turns of phrase that they said in reality that are in the book, and so it comes across as real. One last thing that we can do, not with Chinese officers, but I my guess is a lot of my peers here do, is that when you create something, you can also, you share it with others, both to get their feedback on the fiction side, but also the real world side. So, a F-15 pilot was like, actually, I would have pulled this turn rather than that turn. Or one of the interesting things that when you're dancing in this space is it's not the big stuff. It's that if you get the tiny detail wrong, that one detail wrong, a Navy officer would say this rather than that, they won't believe the whole plot. And so I share my stuff and we share it widely to get that kind of feedback, to check it. It's basically red teaming it. It's red teaming your own work.
Right. Brad, you've had now a ton of bad guys, a ton of people you've had to kind of put yourselves in the shoes of. You keep saying number one because you're bouncing from different personality to different personality, but how much work do you put into that?
Well, it's a ton of work, and I think this idea of everybody's the hero and the victim in their own story in real life and that people are complex and they're nuanced is very important because you think of the richest bad guys maybe you've ever seen in film, and why do you like him? Why do you like a Hannibal Lecter? Why does he resonate with people? There's some depth there. The sketch from memory of the Duomo that's in his isolation cell. It's just such a fascinating, rich background. You can people relate. So I love this idea that Alex had about taking the bureaucracy of the agency and putting it on the terrorists. It's a funny idea. We can all relate to bureaucracy. That's something we can relate to, somebody stabbing us in the back in the office or trying to take credit for something that they didn't. And it makes it more human. And that's what adds richness to a character. That's what gives you that three-dimensional. The one thing you don't want to ever have anybody say about any character in your book is that they're cardboard or two-dimensional. And I'll tell you, as a fiction author, one of the challenges, particularly for me with those details, is I've got guys and they'll say, okay, Thor, this is the way it really works. You'd have eight cutouts before you get to this point. And I tell them, I said, nobody's going to sit and read through 8 meetings. I can't do this. And Vince, you and I offline a couple of days ago had joked around about, you know, in the movies and there's surveillance and the guy slips the surveillance like in 5 minutes, you know, he puts on a different color sweatshirt or puts a hat on and he's gone. And we know it doesn't work that way. But if you're in the fiction space, your number one job is to entertain. So entertaining, it's got to move quickly, and you do have to get those details right. One of the pieces of fan mail that I'm most proud of is when it comes from men and women in the military, law enforcement, or the intelligence community, and when they say, you nailed it, that's exactly what it was like for me or whatever, that makes me feel really good, because I know if somebody puts a safety on a Glock in a book, that's okay, that's strike one. You know, I won't finish a book. If you get too many small details where you should have been able to go to people and say, hey, is this correct? And you don't get those details right, I won't finish a book. I think it's important. The details are the bedrock of a great thriller.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. And now a word from our sponsor, Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With Sixth Sense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. Visit sixthsense.com to learn why enterprises choose them.
I mean, there's a flip side to that as well, where there's a book, I won't name it, the first chapter of it was so good and so well written to reality that even though the rest of the book was ho-hum, I still recommend it to people, because I'm like, just read the first chapter, the rest of it doesn't matter all that much, but read that first chapter because it gets it so right. And they made a movie out of it, it was bad, but that first chapter really matters. And you know, it's one of these things where that's the trick, and I think that's one of the things that I talked to a couple of you about, is it's hard to find the perfect kind of coming together of talent and writing and people that will literally do the homework and actually get things right. Because we have a lot of formers who are out there who try to write and they just cannot write their way out of a paper bag, and it's formulaic and it's boring. And then there are people out there who can write really well, but they get it all wrong. And so kind of what Brad's talking about here of bringing that together and using life experience is one of the things that we find, particularly because I get asked all the time for recommendations about what fiction to read. And it's tough, it's very difficult. And, you know, you have the old Le Carre and you've got the Ian Flemings, but there's not a whole lot beyond kind of who we have on this call and a couple others that I can point people to because of that problem. Because if you want to be bored to death, go read the former deputy director of whatever's novel, because it's, you know, it's really, really real, but you'll read 4 chapters about a surveillance detection run. Or if you want to have a wonderful book that was turned into 5 movies but is so far from reality, go read that also. It's hard to find that mixture. What's interesting, Sean, is I want to ask you, because you've made, let me call it, not so veiled characters clearly based on real people. I'm thinking of Eric Prince, for example. How much does fiction give you cover for what might be considered problematic writing in other ways, where you can kind of tweak? And actually, you know, Peter writes a lot about American military, and there's obviously people who are not the CNO in real life, but it's a CNO in your book. And there's kind of little issues there too. And I'm sure Alex has written about people she's run into at the CIA and changed their name a little bit too. So I ask you, like, is it nice to be able to kind of go, you know what? Everyone's going to know this is Eric Prince, but he can't sue me because it's not his name.
Yes. I mean, first of all, there's a certain delight in that. I have to be careful about how I say that. But everything that doesn't go into the nonfiction books goes into the fiction books, right? And it gives you license to express ideas that we should all think about. And all my characters are based on real people or hybrids. And it's more work of, it's not so much work of imagination as of observing. But the key, and as Brad has said, is as a thriller writer, you can never lose sight that you have to keep the reader turning the pages. Never stop the reader from turning the pages. And I don't know what Peter's opinion was, but I found going from nonfiction to fiction and back to nonfiction to be kind of a struggle. It's like your brain or my brain works in different ways. And also something Alex might talk about is that I am still in the government. So everything has to be cleared through the Department of Defense. I hold top secret clearance. That I have to be very careful of red lines. And you can do that if you know what you're doing and you're careful. But it also changes. There's a con to having too much grounding sometimes in what you're writing about.
Yeah, Peter, go ahead.
So two things, I think. One is what I love about, I'm based in Washington, D.C., and I wonder if the other folks have had this experience, is there are many people who think that there are certain characters drawn from them based on them, but it is always the heroes. It's always the hero, you know, the people that come out. Well, no one ever says, oh, you know, that awful bureaucrat, that was me. And there tends to be a little bit more inspiration on that on the DC side. But to Sean's point, I think there are some similarities, but key differences of when you're going back and forth between fiction and nonfiction. Both of them, you have to have sort of a strategic plan. You're building information of large scale down to tiny details, and then you're figuring out your outline, be it of your argument or be it of the character's journey. Now with nonfiction, it's a little bit more of a grind, but the difference I found between fiction and nonfiction is those wonderful moments of inspiration that hit you in the most random places. It might be out on a walk, it might be in a shower, it might be in a conversation, and you get that little spark of a breakthrough moment of, ooh, this is the character is going to do this, or oh, we just solved how, you know, the character gets out of the locked room, so to speak. With nonfiction, you don't have those lightning bolt moments. It's more about just kind of pounding through the topic. And that to me is sort of the difference of it. And why, you know, frankly, writing fiction is more fun to me personally. I still do both, but it's the one that I find more enjoyable.
Yeah. One of my favorite lines is from Mark Twain, and Clancy would parrot the line, which is the difference between fiction and reality is people expect fiction to make sense.
Good.
I can imagine someone writing a fiction book about 2020. You know, yeah. You get chapter 18 and there's a dust storm coming from Africa. It'd be like, right.
That never would happen. Never get published either.
You dropped the, where did the murder hornets go? You dropped the narrative of the murder hornets.
That's one of the problems that I had, actually. When I first wrote Victor in the Rubble, I took a number of real anecdotes of absurd things that had happened to me, to my friends, my colleagues. I twisted and I played with them so that they were fictionalized. But and then I kind of hid them and made up other absurdities, you know, so it was kind of hidden inside the other absurdities. And my editor would sign off and be like, I get this. This one is just ridiculous. It's got to come out. You're going to lose the reader. And it was like the one that was real, you know, like that's it. Fiction has to make sense and the real world just doesn't.
So well, true.
A million questions, but I want to ask one last question before I turn it over to the audience and to Amanda. We know what Brad has coming up. His new novel, Near Dark, comes out on July 21st. And I know everyone else has basically just released a book relatively soon. But writers write. So I'm assuming you're either getting ready for what's next or already working on it. So let me go and ask each of you, starting with Peter, what's next? Is it back to nonfiction or you're going, I know you just had a book come out, but it's very rare that we just stop and do nothing.
I'm just trying to figure out where to get, you know, a steady supply of toilet paper and all the rest from. I'm joking, but yeah, there's some other projects. But again, the wonderful difference between fiction and reality is that I can actually do operational security on my own work in a way that, you know, U.S. military would have revealed through acquisition plans and the like. So I'm steering away from it. I'm too busy right now, frankly, you know, trying to spread the word about Burn-In. So thanks.
Great. Sean?
So I just had a book release, High Treason, my third novel, about 2 or 3 weeks ago. So I am like Peter in the gerbil wheel phase of spreading the word. But I'm thinking either a fiction book akin to something like 7 Days in May, but, you know, many years ago. You know, Tom Locke is a lot of fun, but there's other things to explore. I don't want to, you know, be locked into that, to use a bad pun. Or I've got a lot of people asking me to do a sequel for The New Rules of War, maybe The New Rules of Diplomacy or The New Rules of something else. So I'm still playing with both. I probably will do both, but the question is in what order?
Well, and Alex is loving life in Europe right now, so she has no need to write more, but I know she's thinking about it. So what's next for Alex Finley?
Yeah, so my second novel, Victor in the Jungle, came out a year ago. And so now I'm working on the third novel, but I'm not telling anybody yet what it's about.
And all of you are in a position that's not very, it's unenviable. For those that just have a book come out, this is not the best time not to be able to travel around and talk about that book. You know, and Alex is in somewhat similar position. It's been about a year, which is kind of when the thinking paperbacks and stuff moving forward to that. This is the broad Vince wants to know, and maybe maybe the listeners do also, but I want to know, how frustrating has this been? I mean, for professionals, obviously this has been a hard time, but the whole key to writing books, whether they're fiction or nonfiction, is when people find out about them, maybe they'll be interested and they want to buy them, but if they don't know they exist, then you can never get them off the shelves. So Brad, you know, this is not a great time to be released. Even July 21st is not great. I mean, how much struggle have you gone through trying to get information out?
Well, you can look at it as a struggle, or you can look at it as just a field filled with opportunity. Talib, who did Black Swan, had a book back in 2012 called Anti-Fragile. No language has a word for the opposite of fragile, where if you shake the hell out of it, it actually gets stronger. So he coined this term anti-fragile, and it's all about taking advantage of black swan events. So I've looked at this as a positive of saying, you know, we were always competing with people watching TV, on the internet, all this kind of stuff. The one thing we don't have, right, we've got everything we've had before. You can advertise on Facebook, you can get the word out on social media. The one thing you don't have, but it's starting to change, Barnes & Noble is opening back up, so you're getting foot traffic in stores. That was the big thing we were concerned with, is foot traffic. But if you look at it from a position of what's the opportunity here, that's where you're going to be successful. So now we're doing tons of virtual events for Near Dark, and I will likely have more people show up for a virtual event on a Thursday evening than would get in their car and drive down to their local independent or their local Barnes & Noble to sit for 2 hours, listen to me talk, get a photograph. I miss the personal connection, the warmth that I have with the readers. I'm very, you know, I'll sit and shake hands and sign every book until everybody's done. So I miss that human contact, but I think we're actually going to be reaching more people with this virtual tour that I'm doing this year than ever before. So it's an opportunity, and that's the way I look at it.
And I imagine people have more time on their hands, and if they're working from home and not commuting, and others that they're looking for entertainment, and perhaps they want to go to a Spire techno thriller for that entertainment.
Yep.
Yes.
So one of the things is, I think you put it into context, and yes, you know, it's a challenging environment all around, and certainly to release a new product in, and you know the publishing industry is facing a lot of issues. You don't get the, you know, the walk-by traffic at the airport, someone going on vacation, seeing it in a bookstore. I mean, that's just the reality of it, but you put it in the context. I mean, you know, for August and myself, both our wives work in healthcare. And you know, so we're writers, like we're not essential compared to them being the essential ones, right? But I think one of the things that you are, or at least I've tried to do, you know, is you're trying to fall of hitting two different poles, which are sound hard to link together, but it's being both escapist and relevant. So escapist, you want to give people something enjoyable, something to fall away into, a different world. But I do think, given at least if you want sort of the ability beyond just straight advertising, what they would call earned media, it has to be relevant to what's going on. And it doesn't mean it has to be exactly on it, but you know, for us, it's the idea that many of the trends that were in play before coronavirus with technology have all been advanced by it. And so the issues, you know, the rollout of AI, surveillance, et cetera, simply put, the things that our characters experience are gonna come true in the real world more rapidly. But I think you do have to be able to speak to something that's going on. But there's a final thing that I would push out there that's interesting, just as a data point. During World War II, British book sales in an actual rationing, British book sales actually doubled. And what it is that people do, there is a value to books in even kind of the darkest of times. And one of the fallaway things in particular is even in dystopian fiction, it's always a story of perseverance. So I think one of the relevant things that you can say, whatever the book topic, is that you're following a journey of a character on a tough time. We're all feeling that too. And so that's, you know, that's another part of the story that you can tell in even tough times to make your project relevant, whether it's a spy thriller or a romantic comedy. It's always a story of perseverance.
Well, I could ask another 50 questions, but I know the audience is gonna have some. So let me bring Amanda Oki back on to ask to some of the questions from the audience that have been sending them in. There's Amanda.
Hello.
Take over a little bit here.
Hi. So since we were mentioning the pandemic, someone asked a question about how would the pandemic, do you think this is something that is ever going to be useful in fiction, in thrillers, like this pandemic landscape? I know we're all still in it. But or is there going to be any appetite for that? That is a broad question.
Alex.
I think actually, yeah. I mean, I am now writing my third novel. I actually started it during the quarantine. And there was, one of the hard things about starting it was what you guys were all referring to before is this going to be relevant post-coronavirus? Like what I'm writing about, is it even going to matter anymore? But I think it's actually laying a really interesting landscape. I think there's it makes us think about bioterrorism differently, and maybe there are, you know, themes that you can play with there. But also I wrote an article with a former colleague, David Priest, about how do you spy when the world is shut down?
David.
And you know, when all of these lockdowns came in, what does an operations officer do? But we have to keep getting information, right? And especially there's been a lot of concern, what's the origin of the virus? How do we get that? When you cannot go out and meet a source, you can't travel anymore. You're not doing brush passes. You're not doing brief encounters. You can't do any of this. So how do you spy in that kind of a world? And I think that actually, that's a fertile ground, I think, to dig into for fiction.
Yeah, I saw you, Brad. I would say, like, we as a museum haven't even started thinking about that yet. Like, I know we're going to have to start thinking about, like, the impact of the coronavirus on the broader national security intelligence world. We just haven't really had the time to kind of hunker down. So it's interesting to hear you say that, Alex. Brad?
So I'm going to combine what Alex and Peter have both said. So I've done two novels that dealt with, so one was bioterrorism, my book Blowback, and then Code of Conduct was about a virus. And so what's interesting is at those times we weren't dealing with those things. So Alex is absolutely right. If you're supposed to be 6 feet apart from somebody and you're wearing a mask, I mean, all these things we think about, brush passes and in meetings in different places, how do you do that? So to Alex's point, absolutely right. And to link it to Peter's point, I'm not going to write in a post-COVID world because I think for the next year or two, people are still going to want that escape. And that's what I'm in the business of selling is escape. It's book in the hand, toes in the sand. I want you to forget about everything else. So I'm not going to touch this the same way I never touched Bin Laden because I knew eventually he was going to end up dead. And I don't want to have a book coming out and it's Corona, 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 and there's a vaccine and Corona's gone or it's disappeared like SARS. So I'm staying away from it for the next couple of years at least.
Peter?
No, I think what we've seen both in the pandemic, but also in the wave of protests following George Floyd's killing is a surfacing of issues and trends and frankly weaknesses and divisions that were already there, just kind of making it more self-evident, whether it's the, you know, to link to Brad's point, whether it's the fragility of the US healthcare system or, you know, obviously police killings. But what I'm getting at is that I do think one of the effects that we all, both as a nation, but also as writers are gonna have to deal with is that these issues have been surfaced. They're in your face now. There's and cutting through all of them, you know, whether it's the idea of these new technology trends to healthcare to whatnot is I'd tweak a little bit, Brad, which you I wouldn't say fragility, it's a brittleness to America. Various things that seemed kind of strong that are actually quite breakable. And I think for all of us as writers, whatever the setting is, whether it's a geopolitical story or something just said in one kind of neighborhood, we are going to have to kind of deal with that context. It may not have to be, it's not a pandemic story, but it is a different America and a different way of both the world looks at us. And we also kind of look at ourselves that comes out of this.
And that's a great point where I've been focused, particularly during this current administration, because of the divisions and people are pro, they're con. I've taken a lot of my storylines out of the White House because I don't want people to read too much into them. So I'm playing a little bit with the bureaucracy at the agency and things like this. But where I shifted several years ago was what happens with a war-weary public who's been in Afghanistan. We've sent our sons and daughters to Iraq. And what happens if a small Baltic state gets invaded by the Russians, one of our NATO partners? We have that Article 5 in the NATO Charter, an attack on one is an attack on all. And so I've pivoted to try to get away from some of the domestic politics to recognize fragility and some of these other things and say, okay, what would America be willing to do to avoid getting pulled into an Article 5? That way I can encompass everyone without really appearing to come down on a side politically. So I know just as a pure fiction author, I've really had to be careful about how I'm threading the needle because again, I don't want to turn people off. I want to turn them on. I want them to flip those pages and have a great read.
Another question about, you know, really what's happening today. How do social movements affect you all, impact you all as writers? Are you feeling a need now to have more diverse characters? You know, have you been feeling that need? Or do you just, you know, go with what is selling?
Sean, this is a great question for you. Is the areas that you operate within yeah. your books and reality. Yeah.
So my fiction is closely based on things I've done or know about. It's not just pure imagination. And one of the things that I've really striven to accentuate are strong female characters in the thriller genre, because there for decades, many authors, not on this call, obviously, female characters have been stock characters, right? They really haven't evolved much yet. I know women from the field and, you know, women like Alex and others, right? who are strong heroes in their own right, and we need to think about this differently beyond the mold. And I use fiction again. It's not just to it's not just to tell about current events. It's also to inform us with a mirror. How do we think about ourselves and our society?
Can I
Alex.
Okay. I think it's an interesting question, actually, because I've been asked the question. My protagonist is Victor Caro. He's a man. And then people have asked me, well, why didn't you make your protagonist a woman? And while I understand the writing to escape and all of that, I also was trying to highlight some of the reality of what it is to work inside the bureaucracy. And I started Victor in the Rubble actually with a female character. And she was running into problems that I wasn't interested in dealing with yet. I actually think that women officers have to juggle things differently sometimes than the men do. And it was simply going towards subjects I wasn't prepared at that point to write about. I didn't want to be writing about it. So I made the conscious decision actually to change and to make a male protagonist.
Peter?
It's interesting. So our protagonist in Burn-In is a female, and echoing what Sean said, I think there's a challenge in the field of either they're not there, they're one dimensional, or they're, if they are there, they're the 1B, they're always the helper to the male hero. And Keegan at the center of our story, you know, she's based off of real world people. And I think part of that is also allows you to develop a richer character. So yes, she's a FBI agent, but she's also a mom of a 5-year-old. She's also in a marriage that's falling apart. And that allows you, I think, to it's a more entertaining journey because it's more realistic because we have these sort of multiple identities that we're all juggling. I will say, you know, what I try and do is mirror the sort of the diversity of the real world. And it, you know, you in the real world, you've got people of different ethnicities, you've got people of different sexual orientations. And, you know, you reflect that in your characters. I do think there's what, in terms of the new that I've grown more conscious of over the last several months, is a movement to lift up other voices in our professional setting. So, for example, a couple of days from now, there's a online, it's called Share the Mic. And basically, it's for people like myself who work in cybersecurity, and we are handing over our social media platforms, in this case, to just a phenomenal African-American woman who works in cybersecurity, to help sort of share the mic and get her, you know, use the platform that I've got to help her reach wider audiences, and then people will follow her. So I think what I'm getting at is that we can, there's what we can do in our fiction, but there's also different various things that we can do in the role that we have as kind of, you know, professionals in this space.
That is terrific. Now this one, I really enjoyed this question, which is, how do you think novels like yours or novels from the past have served as, say, open source for our adversaries or friendly adversaries? How do you think this has shaped what other countries or terrorist groups think about the U.S.?
Sean, start.
I may have a similar experience to Peter, I can only guess, but I, for my nonfiction, The New Rules of War, I was remember briefing at Whitehall, which is sort of the Pentagon in London for the British Ministry of Defense, and a very concerned general came up to me and says, "You should never have written this because now our adversaries will read it and get ideas." And they'll reference things like, you know, Blitzkrieg and Billy Mitchell. In the 1920s and 30s, it had these people who are rightly or wrongly attributed to allies giving their enemies their own ideas of demise. And of course, the novel's High Treason is an example of that in real time, but fun. So, but I think ultimately, for me, my calling is to show these ideas and let people think of them what they may. And Peter, I know you've done some very similar things, and probably Brad, since you're red teaming for the Pentagon, we know that you've done these things.
So I'll jump in on that. I had, you know, two funny experiences that sort of illustrate this. One was You know, you get various people that come up to you at different book events, and at one event, a Chinese PLA colonel came up to me and, you know, talked about how popular your book is among our officers, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I smiled back and said, oh, that's interesting because I didn't sell the Chinese language rights. And, you know, he had a smile back, which was, yeah, we, you know, intellectual property theft of a different kind. And then you also have, and this may be the others, you have people with really, really bad tradecraft that show up at your event. So, you know, he was in uniform. It was very obvious. There's also been, you know, attractive young women. And you're like, come on, this is like, we can see through what's going on here. But, you know, to the point of the concern, my answer to it is they already know. And, you know, so like as an example, we in Burn-In, there is a cybersecurity vulnerability in water treatment plants that the bad guys go after. I'm plot spoiling a little bit, but it happened in Israel 2 weeks ago in reality. It wasn't because someone read the book and that quickly deployed. It was a known vulnerability among bad guys. What we're doing just is surfacing it for people on the defender side to be aware of it, talk about it, do something about it. And so in many ways, what, you know, besides entertainment, when you move over to the useful fiction side, what you're trying to do is not prediction, but prevention.
All right. We have a ton of questions, and I want everyone to know we will do our best to email the list to all the authors. They're very particular ones, but this seems like a nice final question. We'll run over a couple minutes so everyone can answer this. But of course, what advice would you give to young authors starting out in this genre?
Brad, start us off.
So one of the greatest lines I've ever heard, and I share this with every young author I meet. I ask them a question. Do you know what the difference is between a published author and a non-published author? The published author never quit. And you need that special operations mentality. It is all about your determination, your grit. Don't quit. Have the sensory acuity to be able to take constructive criticism so you can make your craft better, but don't quit. That's the difference. And I would encourage people, it's a siren song to just go self-publish someplace. But if you're good, stay at it. Try to get with one of the big publishing houses. Just keep hitting it, keep hitting it, keep hitting it. And final thing, whenever you read agents, when you query agents, the agents will say, only query one agent at a time. That is the worst piece of advice you're ever going to get, because it could take 3 months for an agent to get back to you. Pick the top 10, top 15 you love and shotgun them. Whoever gets you first is lucky. Don't let them set the rules. You set the rules.
Wow. That was tough. Who else?
Alex.
I would say the best is just write and don't censor yourself and just keep going. Like Brad said, it's just, we all have it in us to do it. So if you like it, just do it.
Sean.
I think writing is a two-step process. It's throw up, clean up. And I joke that some people ask me like, well, how do you write, you know, nonfiction and fiction? And I say, well, for serious nonfiction, it's up early in the morning, lots of coffee. For fiction, late at night, scotch.
There you go. I like that.
And Peter.
Study the fiction that you love and pull back and think about why do you love it? And it might be the overall themes. It might be the little moments in it. And when I say fiction, I mean not just novels, but of any form. There's a scene in our book that came out of me sort of wrestling with what I love so much about Tarantino movies. And so again, you know, we're all readers first. So if you love this style, this approach, this little detail, if you bake it into your work, then it's going to be all the more compelling.
Wow. This was so fun. I enjoyed listening to you all chat with each other as well. And
can I jump in really quickly and say, if you like any of these authors, I've podcasted with all of them, and I will podcast with Brad before his book comes out. There's a couple with Sean, there's one with Alex, there's one with Peter on Ghost Fleet, and we might do it again sometime in the future. So go to Spycast. You can have your long conversations one-on-one, with each of these authors. And again, Brad, that'll come out right when his book comes out to hear about what's happening with Near Dark. So thank you.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit. If you want to donate to the museum, or if you're local and want to volunteer at the museum, please visit our website at spymuseum.org for more information.
Today's episode is sponsored by SRM, your first call for cybersecurity and investigations. Threats today are evolving faster than ever before, and since 2005, SRM has pioneered tailored security solutions for global corporations and their executives. Whether it's defending against cyber attacks with their award-winning team of ethical hackers and incident response specialists, or navigating the murky waters of compliance and ESG challenges, SRM's insight and straightforward advice will help you navigate complex risks and emerge more resilient. Their secret? A culture that nurtures the sharpest minds, giving them access to the newest technologies and the freedom to solve problems in new ways, enabling them to craft simple, effective solutions for your unique cyber challenges. Search Your First Call to discover how SRM can help your business.